Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the RBC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby and today I'm talking with Professor Dan Brockman of the RBC's Department of Veterinary Clinical Studies about congenital heart valve disease in dogs and how he can solve this by open heart surgery. So thanks very much for joining us, Dan, today. What sort of cases are referred to you then in your role as a cardiac surgeon?
Well, I suppose that the truth is that my niche interest is in cardiac surgery, although I'm a general surgeon in the broader sense. But I've developed skills in cardiac surgery, and probably most of the cardiologists throughout the UK are aware that we have capabilities in surgery here at the Royal Veterinary College that are slightly greater than at other referral centres and university hospitals throughout the country. So when patients that have diseases that are not easily managed surgically but that require surgical treatment are identified, many of the cardiologists throughout the UK contact me to inquire as to whether that patient is going to benefit from an intervention. So it's a very specialised group of patients. They're usually animals that have been already seen by secondary referral cardiologists, right, and they've identified either an anatomical or a degenerative condition in the heart that is going to be amenable to surgery, and then that's when they contact me to find out whether it's something that we can actually provide a solution for.
Okay, so what sort of conditions are you tending to see then in your role?
We've seen several different types of intracardiac disease. Very rare conditions like tetralogy of Fallot, we developed a treatment that will increase the amount of blood flow to the lungs for dogs that have tetralogy. Dogs with tetralogy typically have a large amount of blood shunting from the right side of their heart over to the left side. So the lungs are relatively underperfused, and we developed a procedure to increase the lung perfusion. So we get that sort of patient, but for the intracardiac repairs and other diseases that we treat, mostly we've seen dogs with AV or atrioventricular valve disease, and mostly these have been tricuspid valve patients. And we've seen a number of dogs with pulmonic stenosis, and that is narrowing of the pulmonic valve. And for the dogs with the atrioventricular valve disease, we've performed valve replacements on a number of dogs. And for the dogs with pulmonic stenosis, we have performed what's called an open patch graft technique to open and widen the narrow area that regulates blood flow from the heart into the lungs.
Okay, so you're actually looking at both congenital and acquired disease then in terms of your surgical treatment.
I think ultimately the goal will be to develop good techniques that we can use in dogs with acquired predominantly valvular and predominantly mitral valvular disease. They're a very challenging group of patients. So what we've focused on for the early part of our time doing cardiopulmonary bypass and open heart procedures here is identifying patients that have a good functioning left ventricle, left side to the heart, but have right-sided disease. And the reason for this is that dogs that have a good functioning left ventricle are much more likely to recover from a period of cardiopulmonary bypass. It just so happens, too, that pulmonic stenosis, although it's a condition that can be treated well by non-surgical means, there is a subset of dogs that don't respond well to medical or interventional techniques for which there is no other solution. So without this intervention, they're going to be in very poor shape and have a much reduced quality of life and a much reduced length of life.
Okay, so how does a case of pulmonic stenosis usually present, I guess, to a referring practitioner and then to you?
Well, I think usually, most commonly, the story starts when these animals are presented to their primary care practitioner for vaccination. And the detection of a murmur at vaccination is obviously something you would expect in an animal with a congenital disease, a disease that it's been born with. So pretty soon after that initial presentation, if that murmur doesn't disappear, and occasionally there are age-related flow murmurs that are usually quite subtle, but they can disappear. If they don't disappear, then they get referred to a cardiologist for further evaluation. The cardiologist then typically will evaluate the animal, but usually the definitive anatomical diagnosis is confirmed during an echocardiographic examination. And during that time, the cardiologist can gain some idea of the severity of the abnormality. And so, taking pulmonic stenosis as a specific example, the velocity that blood reaches as it travels through the narrow valve area is an indication of the pressure gradient between the right ventricle and the pulmonary artery. And the higher the pressure gradient, the more at risk the dog is for shortening lifespan and reduced quality of life. The quality of life decision is often difficult in these young puppies because they are young puppies and they're often very lively. But typically for a puppy of 6 to 8 months, if the pressure gradient is greater than 60 or 70 millimeters of mercury, then we would anticipate that animal is going to have severe difficulty with its pulmonic stenosis. It will be to the point where its life expectancy is only a couple of years, and that animal will need some kind of intervention.
Okay, so you're relying really on what I guess is a technique now that's fairly widely available, the ultrasound echocardiography, and people to refer to you when they see this extreme pressure of ejection there.
That's right, and you're correct that echocardiography has become the mainstay of anatomical cardiac abnormality diagnosis. And the referring cardiologist has to decide, first of all, whether the stenosis is severe enough to warrant intervention. And once an intervention is deemed appropriate, to refer that patient, if they aren't prepared to perform the intervention themselves, to somewhere where they are. And the first line intervention that all cardiologists and actually cardiac surgeons too would recommend is a non-surgical interventional radiology technique known as balloon valvuloplasty. And this is a technique where a balloon is inserted either up the femoral vein or down the jugular vein into the right side of the heart, and this balloon is passed into the narrow valve area. And then this is a special balloon that, once it's inflated, inflates to a certain diameter and hopefully will expand the fused valve leaflets and break the areas of fusion apart and allow the valve to operate like a normal valve. So that's the first line of treatment that we would all recommend for animals with pulmonic stenosis.
And that's a treatment that can be offered fairly widely these days.
Many centres throughout the UK, both university hospitals and private referral centres, can offer this as a treatment. The population of dogs that we then ultimately operate on are going to be animals that have failed to respond to balloon dilation. And typically, and this is fortunate for us too, these dogs are typically larger dogs with a valve abnormality that is more than simple fusion of otherwise normal valve leaflets. These are animals that have valves that are severely deformed. Typically they are fused, but they are very knobbly and hard and immobile. And they represent essentially a fixed obstruction at the right ventricular outflow tract.
Mm-hmm. And what's the prognosis without surgery for dogs with this particular severity?
Again, almost regardless of the valve morphology or what the valve looks like, providing the gradient is low, they can tolerate this for a normal lifespan. But we would target, again, in young adults, pressure gradients that are between 60 and 70, and mature dogs, a pressure gradient over 100 millimeters of mercury. It's been clearly shown that these populations of dogs have a severely limited life expectancy. It's very difficult for each individual to say exactly how long, but the literature would suggest that a pressure gradient of over 100 millimeters of mercury in an adult life is indicative of a median life expectancy of about 2 years, 2 to 3 years.
Right, so in acute failure will occur?
Ultimately progressive right-sided cardiac failure. Mm. But the secondary events that follow pulmonic stenosis are very thickened right ventricular muscle. If you like, the muscle of the right side of the heart has been working against a resistance for a long time. It gets very thick. Once the muscle thickness exceeds the ability of the blood vessels within the muscle to supply oxygen, then bits of that muscle can die and arrhythmias, abnormal cardiac rhythms, can develop. So either these dogs develop what we call an arrhythmic event and die as a result of that, or they develop such high pressures in the right ventricle that the valve between the ventricle and the atrium becomes so leaky that blood backs up in the system and creates failure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you've got a sort of milder case, it is possible, though, to manage them medically.
Absolutely. And the milder cases will be identified by the cardiologists, and typically the advice for very mild cases is to do nothing. For intermediate cases, because balloon valve dilation is so benign, there is some benefit to attempting that, even for intermediate cases. Clearly, for severely affected animals, an intervention is important, and the first line will be balloon dilation. If that fails, then they'll get on the phone to me to see if we can operate on the dog under bypass.
Okay, so what are the advantages then in following the surgical route over just the balloon valvuloplasty?
Well, the advantages of surgery are that we get an opportunity to directly visualize the abnormal valve. We can very accurately place usually a piece of surgical Gore-Tex, expanded polytetrafluoroethylene material in the form of a sheet. We can sew that over the outflow tract and be absolutely certain that what we've done is relieve the obstruction. Mm-hmm. So in fact, if we ignore the potential risk to the patient, there is a theoretical advantage of surgery over balloon valvular dilation as well. But the downside of surgery is that it carries a higher risk to the patient. It's more expensive, and it's a very large undertaking for our team. We need to remove blood from the heart as it comes into the heart and return it to the circulation once it's gone through a piece of apparatus that essentially replaces the activities of the heart and the lungs. So the heart-lung machine is a mechanical device that removes blood from the heart, oxygenates the blood, and returns it back into the arterial system. And although that sounds very straightforward and nice, it's not quite the same as normal body physiology. So this technique and this machinery, although it's essential to do what you need to do inside the heart, is damaging to the blood vessels because it's non-pulsatile flow that returns to the dog's body. Mm-hmm. It's damaging to the red blood cells and activates white blood cells, so it triggers red cell disintegration and white cell activation and inflammation. And also, many of the filters that are in place to reduce the risk of microemboli being returned to the dog also filter out platelets. And of course, platelets are very important for blood clotting after surgery like this. So going on to bypass, although it's essential, is also very damaging. And it's a fine balancing act between getting the operation performed as quickly as you can and as accurately as you can so that you can reduce the total length of time that the animal is on bypass versus getting the result that you ultimately want.
And just to sort of summarise what bypass is necessary for, obviously you're going to stop the heart because you have to go into the heart to do the surgery, and then you're plumbing in the machine to the existing blood vessels to bypass it.
That's absolutely right. We need to have a bloodless field. And we also need to make sure that oxygen is being delivered to all the other vital organs during the time that the heart is stationary and emptied of blood. So the blood drains from the main veins or even the right side of the heart, the right atrium, and is typically returned back into one of the main arteries. And usually we use the carotid artery. It's a large artery in the neck. We can get all of the blood flow required to maintain that animal's life back down its carotid artery. And fortunately, the arterial system doesn't have any valves within it, so that blood, once it's injected back into the carotid artery, gains access to the entire rest of the body.
Okay, well, perhaps you could go on and give us a blow-by-blow account of the surgery itself.
So, from a technical point of view, anaesthetizing these patients is challenging, but also positioning, because we don't do this regularly, making sure all the catheters and cannulas are in the right place so that we can go on bypass is quite a challenge. But once we get to the point where the animal is now having its blood shunted through the bypass machine, the heart is empty, the heart is stopped, then the time has come to be as efficient as we can with the intracardiac manipulations. For dogs with pulmonic stenosis, we start by opening the main artery that provides the blood to the lungs, the pulmonary artery, and then continue that cut across the very narrow pulmonic valve into the wall of the right ventricle. We open the right ventricular outflow tract using that incision as wide as we can and evaluate the pulmonic valve, and usually we will remove parts of the pulmonic valve to increase the area through which blood can flow.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we take a sheet of Gore-Tex and model the Gore-Tex sheet so that it's rounded at the edges and such that it fits the length of the incision that we've created in the outflow tract. And then, again, using a Gore-Tex suture material, we very carefully suture the sheet of Gore-Tex into the edges of the incision that we've created. And this has the effect not only of allowing us to remove parts of the valve that are abnormal, but it allows us to expand the diameter of the outflow tract. And I think the analogy that people usually understand the most is if you've got a favorite pair of jeans that are just too tight, you can unpick the back of the jeans and insert a piece of material in the back that will allow them to fit you more comfortably again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we're doing with the outflow tract. This piece of Gore-Tex is an expansion to the outflow tract. And so we very carefully suture that in a way that we hope will be watertight. And once we have finished suturing that in place, we remove all the air that remains in the heart and begin the process of starting the heart up again. Usually, to give ourselves a bit of added protection during the period of cardioplegia or arrested heart, we cool the entire dog's body, the animal's body, to a temperature around 28 degrees centigrade, whereas normal would be around 38.
Mm-hmm.
The myocardium, the heart muscle itself, gets cooled to about 4 degrees. And this is all to protect the whole body and reduce the amount of oxygen it requires, but also to protect the heart muscle as well. We start to rewarm the animal just as we're placing the last few stitches in the patch to seal the patch to the heart muscle. We also, once we've sealed the heart and the patch is on and we've removed the air, we remove the clamp that was preventing blood from circulating around the heart muscle, and we allow now the warmer blood to circulate into the heart muscle itself. Very often, the heart will spontaneously start to beat on its own. Occasionally, spontaneous rhythm does not return, and we have to give the heart an electric shock to start contractions again. Once we're happy that the heart is contracting regularly enough to support normal cardiac output, then we're in a position to slowly wean the dog off the heart-lung machine. And this is a process that often can take between 15 and 30 minutes. Mm. But obviously the idea is to reduce the amount of blood that we siphon off the heart into the machine that's replacing the heart and lung function, and allow the heart to then pump the blood in a more normal fashion around the lungs and then back out into the circulation. So that's a gradual process that will take several minutes. Once we're happy that the heart is beating, and it's beating to a level that will support life, we slowly remove all the catheters and cannulas that we placed, that we used for the cardiopulmonary bypass in the first place.
Okay, and the procedure as a whole must be several hours in total.
We typically start operating on these animals around about 9:30 in the morning, and they will have their chest completely closed by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
So with such a complicated procedure, there must be a lot of post-operative attention that's necessary. So what's actually involved here?
Well, as I mentioned, the physical act of putting these dogs on and off bypass is damaging to their body. We trigger a lot of inflammatory white cells to react in the body, and they will be creating a condition known as post-bypass systemic inflammatory response. So these patients need to be monitored really carefully. They go into the intensive care unit, and occasionally they will be placed on a mechanical ventilator for a period of a few hours. Mm-hmm. But usually the tube that we use to anaesthetize them, that's in their windpipe or their trachea, is removed by about 2 or 3 hours after surgery. And then we are going to very intensively monitor blood pressure, the electrocardiogram, urine output, central venous pressure, and all of these things are going to be used to give us a good idea as to whether our fluid replacement or blood product replacement is adequate, whether the perfusion of the body is adequate, and whether the heart continues to support good blood pressure. In addition to that, we'll frequently measure the arterial blood gas concentration to make sure that the lungs are working adequately, mm-hmm. and also the acid-base balance of the patient to make sure that, again, the perfusion is adequate and that the electrolytes and acid-base balance are being maintained. That intensive monitoring will take place usually for the first 12 to 24 hours. And I like to think of these operations in terms of milestones and objectives, if you like, that the big hurdle to get over, first of all, is getting the animal through the operation. And that's a big hurdle. The second major hurdle is getting them through that first 24 hours of recovery, where all of those detrimental effects of being on cardiopulmonary bypass are at their height, or at their worst, if you like. That systemic inflammatory response can affect peripheral circulation, peripheral vasculature, and also the lungs. And so very often, if a problem develops, it will be manifest in terms of persistent low blood pressure despite adequate fluid resuscitation and blood volume support, or deteriorating lung function despite adequate oxygen supplementation. And so those are often the key things that we'll look for. Preceding those might be changes in things such as the acid-base balance associated with a build-up of lactic acid or lactate associated, again, with poor body tissue perfusion.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of things, obviously, to monitor. I guess the dogs must be hospitalised for several days, best case.
These dogs typically stay in the hospital for at least 6 days. Mm. That intensive period of monitoring will last up to 24 hours, but they remain in the intensive care unit for usually 4 or 5 of those days. I think it's probably becoming quite clear to you that this kind of endeavour would be impossible without a very well coordinated team effort. We both need the careful selection process that occurs in our cardiology team. We need the incredible support we get from our anesthesia team. We hire a perfusionist, someone who is skilled at running a heart-lung machine and has been doing this type of procedure for human patients for a lifetime, because that's another very critical step. If something goes wrong with the perfusion, doesn't matter how good the surgeon and the anaesthetists are, then the patient will be lost because of that. So anaesthesia team, surgery team, perfusionist, and then picking up the baton as we move into the critical care arena, the incredible intensive care staff that we have and the effort that's required to keep these animals going through that first critical step.
So what sort of percentage then will you ultimately end up with a pleasing improvement in the situation?
We have now operated on 10 dogs with pulmonic stenosis of the type that I've just described. We have had, sadly, one of the dogs that we operated on did not recover from its anesthesia for the operation. But all of the others have recovered. They have all had significantly reduced pressure gradients, and typically, in fact, if we use the example of the dog we currently have in the hospital, it came into the operation with a pressure gradient of 150 millimeters of mercury, so very severe disease, and it is about to leave the hospital this afternoon, and its pressure gradient is approximately 8 millimeters of mercury. So that's a huge improvement. And that type of change has been mirrored by all the other dogs that we've done this operation on. One of the things that most people are curious about is, because we have essentially removed a valve that would function to regulate flow to the lungs, how dogs tolerate the fact that that valve is no longer there. And I think the veterinary cardiologists throughout the world for years have suggested that dogs will tolerate what we would term as pulmonic valve incompetence very well. We're now in a position where we're testing that hypothesis in real animals. We have had one patient that survived following this operation for nearly 5 years and ultimately died, sadly, of a bone tumour. So died of reasons unrelated to the pulmonic valve. We've had a second dog that survived 4 years, had a very good quality of life, but did actually succumb to cardiac disease, and it was related to leakiness of the valve between his right atrium and right ventricle, his tricuspid valve. So he developed progressive cardiac failure because of a different component of his heart disease. The remainder of the animals that we've operated on have all enjoyed a much improved quality of life and are all still alive, so we're waiting to find out how this treatment is going to compare to other treatments. But we've selected a group of animals that we would have predicted would have not survived more than 2 years, and I think currently our median survival time is somewhere around three and a half years. So I'm very confident that this operation achieves the short-term goal that it sets out, and it looks as though the long-term objectives, which are to take an animal with a severely compromised quality of life and a severely shortened lifespan into an animal with a virtually normal quality of life and a normal lifespan, has almost been reached.
Yes, well, I think those statistics are very impressive. I certainly personally wasn't expecting to hear such a high success rate. And I think on that note, I can say thank you very much, Dan Brockman. And I guess we all look forward to hearing more developments and results of more cases as they come along.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much once again for listening to our latest podcast. We hope very much you'll be back again to hear the next one. In the meantime, if you have any comments or suggestions on the podcast, please feel free to drop us a line at podcast@rvc.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.